Hey.
Well, it took forever.
Oh man.
Persistence, huh? Wow.
I think it was you, not me. Anyway, let me start the show the proper way. This is Stuck in the Attic podcast. And I have Jim Hernandez on from Valor Fitness Clothing. And he's also on Instagram. Do you have any handles you want to put out there?
First of all, hello. Jim Hernandez, alcoholic.
Yeah.
Well, my personal IG handle on Instagram is JHER76. And then my business, as you said, is Valor Fitness Clothing. So, yeah. I know I've listened to a couple of your podcasts. And, you know, I think the way we work is we Google everything or look up everything. So,
oh, yeah.
I was listening, I automatically went to try to look up your guest so I could have a visual. And yeah, I wasn't able to. But
well, now with, you know, you dropping your tag, your handle on here, people will be able to find you, especially Valor Fitness Clothing.
Let me apologize to them now for that, man.
That is some brand you got there. And the stuff that you do, you know, with the work that you do and all helping people out and charity and everything. I mean, you got to talk about, before we get into your story, I want to know about, you know, what's going on with that clothing line and what, you know, I see so many of my friends, we're all, you know, one tight community. So many of my friends repping the Sober AF shirts. And talk about how that came about, you know, like, what made you say, I'm going to start a clothing line? Because business-minded people, you know, are different. I'm not sure if I could do that. But you just, you know, like, what did it take? What idea got in your head to get that going?
Oh, man. I think I've said this multiple times. I think I did everything exactly the opposite way that anybody should try to do anything. So whatever I'm about to say, if you're going to try to start a business, don't listen to me at all. But when I first got sober in 2016, I did it in a program, a transitional rehab facility. A little different, definitely. It was here in Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles, California, but definitely was not one of those little poshy like passages in Malibu or, you know, those really cute ones. It was 53 guys. Most of them were straight out of prison. Or straight off the streets of being homeless, which at the time was my situation. I was homeless, and you know, there's some government-funded programs where if you're in prison, you go before the judge, and the judge is like, "All right, you want to do two more years, or do you want to go to this little, you know, program and stay there for 7 months?" And so, obviously, you know, people pick that. And then for homeless, I was homeless, and my probation officer was able to get me in touch with some people and get some strings pulled. So I definitely. You don't become homeless because you have money. So no. I didn't have money to afford any programs. So it was a government funded. Yeah. Right. So I got into this rehab program, man. It was a 7 month program, and I've always been into fitness, and I've always known the importance of physical fitness. And so when I finally got sober and I started racking up a couple of days, man, we had a gym in the basement, three stories down in this big, used to be a hotel. looked like more of a hostel with 53 guys, and every chance I would get, I'd sneak back down in that gym and decide, you know, worked on myself, mind, body, and soul, and that was the body part. And I've always been into physical fitness, always played sports. So I was like, you know what? That was such a big role in my early recovery and getting my self-esteem, my self-worth, my confidence back, that I was just like, man, I think I really want to use this to try to help other addicts in recovery. Try to aid them and inspire them. And I was like, I had no idea what I was doing. I don't even think I had an IG at the time. I've never made a website, never, no fashion sense whatsoever. But I just knew the word Valor was a very, very powerful word, usually associated with military. But for me at the time, at the end of the couple of last months of my recovery in the program, or last months in the program, not my recovery, but you're able to get a job on the outside, so you can go get some money, so you can, you know, save up a little cash, so when you're done with the program, you can then transition and try to be a productive member in society, and you have a little bit of money to hopefully get an apartment or adjust, et cetera, et cetera. And So I'm out there going to work and whatnot, man, just drugs and liquor were everywhere. You know, I was in Venice Beach where it's a huge homeless population, lots of crystal meth, lots of cocaine, bars, alcohol everywhere. So, you know, Valor commonly stands for being very courageous in the face of danger, and it's associated with the military. And I love that. And I have the utmost respect for that. But as an addict in recovery, man, I felt like every second of every day was a dangerous situation. And I took that word and I was like, you know what, I'm going to name my clothing line, if I ever start one, Ballard Fitness Clothing. And then when I got out of rehab, I think I had saved up like almost $2,000. I went and got an apartment, tried to get an apartment, and I went straight to the county office and filed a DBA. And I made lots of mistakes as far as business-wise, but I haven't quit. And this is the first thing that in my life I can say I started something tonight and I didn't quit it and I haven't quit. So that's a little bit about how I started it.
That's amazing because, like, you know, sometimes, like, great stuff happens because we don't know, like, how to start something. And like, this podcast, dude, I started this podcast by accident because somebody said it was, like, really difficult to get one going. And I'm like, let me see. And I went online, I recorded a trailer, and next thing you know, I'm like, oh, shit. Now I have two things to do. I can either do one, which is like try and get it off of all these platforms, this trailer for that sounds like shit, quite frankly, or I can go ahead and like see if anyone's dumb enough to come on and talk to me and like go on the air, you know, and have their voice, you know, and people are like, yeah, I'll do it. I'm like, man, you're nuts. I'm like, all right, great. Let's do it. Yeah. And that's how it started.
You definitely have the right community in the recovery community to.
What a clusterfuck. It started out like just my first episode wasn't even about recovery. It was about like optimism and overcoming challenges and stuff, you know?
But yeah.
And sometimes I play some background music that's just like classical, you know, like piano stuff, you know?
That,
like,
yeah, we talked about this.
Yeah, that like puts you to sleep a little bit, but you know what? I mean, we can put some funky fresh beats to the back of this if you want, whatever you want to do, you know,
something, man. Yeah. I'm telling you, I loved your shows, but I felt like I was walking into a Chinese massage parlor or something,
or you just like, yeah, just having a cup of tea, talking about
something. Yeah, get ready to meditate.
Well, some of the ones with the, you know, it depends on who you're with, and like I'll lay it out and I'll be with people and I'll say, look, you want this, you want that, and I let people pick, you know, because it's a community thing. It's a jam session. So I don't have to like be overbearing. It's not like you're on my show. You know, there's no content involved. Like, you know, and we could pick something decent out, but sometimes, you know, people just want something that's kind of like chill and smooth. And it, you know, it also sets the tone for like that serious sobriety, you know, cause some people need to hear something like that. And then other people are like, you know what? I had enough of that dreary, dismal bullshit when I was in, you know, whatever house they were in. I don't want to hear that elevator music anymore.
Man, it's funny because I listened. I really enjoyed the episode with Georgia and then Belinda and Amber, but I had to really try to get past that damn music you were playing. And once I just stuck it out and I gave you a couple minutes, I was like, wow, this content is really fuck. I love the content. But I'm just busting your balls, man. I'm just busting your balls. That's what we do.
It's straight up. I let people talk about whatever they want to talk about. Some people need to get some shit off their chest. I mean, believe me. I listen, most of these people that came on the show, I get their ear. And I really lay into them with some of the saddest shit that I got going on in my head. So I'm like, you do whatever you want on my show. Believe me.
Man, that's good stuff, though. When you start getting into that stuff, that's recovery right there. That's growth. And so I respect that, and I totally appreciate that, man.
But growth comes.
I hope I'm not talking too fast. I tend to talk fast and mumble a little bit. So for the whoever's listening, if anybody does listen to this, I apologize ahead of time.
I always trip over my words. I talk fast. Sometimes I mumble. I talk loud, though. That's one thing I've always been told. Like, I can talk right into the mic. Some people are a little shy. You know, you're definitely not. No.
I love it. Not.
But you got a great network going there, man.
Man, you know, it's this sober community, or just not even sober, because, you know, obviously when you say sober, many people associate that with alcohol, and I don't want to, you know, I try to bridge the gap. I think there's definitely a stigma gap between AA and NA, and I don't like that at all. But Sober Clean, this the recovery community, man, the recovery community on social media, it's powerful and it's genuine. And you know, us addicts in recovery, man, it's hard to get our trust. You know, we are skeptical motherfuckers, and so, excuse my language, I only cuss when I talk recovery or
you don't have to. Don't worry about
other
that.
Addicts.
You can talk whatever. You can say whatever you want in here.
I never do, though, unless I'm talking to a big group and in a meeting, or if I'm speaking, it's the only time I cuss. It's so funny. But just the recovery community, man, I think I started my IG and I just went with my old friends, which is a huge mistake, obviously, for an act in recovery to try to, you know, get back with all their old friends they had pre.
That's rough. That would be unwise if I was your sponsor.
Man, right? And so then I just pulled my head out of my ass and I was like, all right, let's dive into this. And man, I met some amazing people and just genuine people, you know. It's like really genuine, and it's hard. I think at first it's hard to realize that these people are genuine, because for so long we were ingenuine ourselves. We were so selfish in our active addiction.
I was full of shit is what I was.
Yeah, man. Lies and manipulations, cheating, stealing, it was all that. So it's just like, you know, trusting myself sometimes is harder to do than the fact that I'm genuine. I, you know, I have to, like, you know, not trick myself, but realizing that I am. And then it's a beautiful thing when you realize other people are as well. So like-minded people, man, staying connected in this community, this recovery community, has been so powerful and so awesome. So I'm blessed.
You know what? It's like, I can reach out to people on here all day long, you know, like some of the people you're talking about before, England, Australia. You know, sometimes I don't have really much to say, so I just want to check in. I don't want to bother someone over here that's sleeping. You know, I don't want to, hey, how's it going? I just thought I wanted to say hi, you know. Asshole, it's 3 a.m. Are you gonna drink? No, I'm not. Son of a bitch. Now I got work.
That's our time. 3 a.m. That's our time. I say us addicts, man, we do the other 9 to 5. We're the 9 p.m. to 5 a.m.
Yeah, I can't stay up late, man. I'm like an old fart.
Oh man, I'm still wired that way. It's miserable. I watch the sunrise more often than I have to admit, but anyways, it's been wired like that. But yeah.
You know, you're talking about the bridge and the gap. I don't know one person under the age of 50 that just did one or the other. Like, everyone was just a dumpster. Just a dumpster of crap. Booze, coke, weed, you know, ecstasy, everything. Everything. The only thing I didn't do was heroin. I took painkillers, but the only thing I didn't do was shoot heroin. That's the only thing I ever did. That, like, I never shot anything, you know. But
yeah,
I put it up my nose. You know, I, you know, whatever. I'd stick it up my ass if I had a chance, but that came later.
Roostering, right?
What do they call them? Butt shots? Butt chugging or something like that.
We call it, well, this is, I heard this from a friend, of course. This isn't for me, but when you stuck an ecstasy pill up your ass, it hits you right away, man. It lasts a little longer.
You know, the first thing I said,
I'm not going to lie, I never did that. My best friend in those years did that. I never did it because I was just, I did ecstasy a lot, but I never did the way I just said it, but he called it roostering. So anyways, we don't need to glorify this.
How do you do that? That's not even like, that wouldn't even be glorifying. Like, I know people used to stick it up their nose. Wouldn't that be sufficient? You can't wait the fucking half hour so the thing kicks in. You gotta.
Bro, when you try to rationalize the shit we did, is when your first mistake, you should realize just
right now, man.
The fucking addicts and active addiction, there's no rhyme or reason to that. But
let me tell you something, I was a better driver drunk. It when someone says that, you're like, oh man,
right?
That's what you think when you're drunk.
Oh yeah, man. But so, crazy.
Let's get into now. You had garden variety, I'm sure, grew up, you know, had your, you know, do you want to talk about what it was like when you first started getting going, getting the ball rolling into some real good addict behavior?
Yeah, man. I think that's where you start your recovery process and growth, is when you can actually really talk about the shit that that happened to you when you were young. And you know, that's when I started actually getting my bit of recovery and being able to get outside my head, because we become addicts because we push shit down. We're trying to run away from it and numb it. So, you know, you talked about growing up. And it's funny because, you know, I'm obviously going to say I had a normal childhood because it was my normal. We all have our normal, and it was all very different. Like, your normal is different than my normal.
Oh, of course.
And at the time, we thought it was normal, you know, because that's all we knew. And so, you know, me growing up, looking back, I can see so much more, and I can, you know, put pieces together, and I can recognize, you know, shortcomings, where I went wrong, what this happened, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I was raised by a single mom who had me when she was 15. Dad was never around. Mom never even graduated high school. And she busted her ass, man. She worked three jobs to provide for me. She did all she did, she could do. She, I would wake up in the morning. This is like, I'm going to start like third grade. I'd wake up in the morning, mom was gone. She was off to her morning waitress job at a restaurant. So I'd get myself together, get myself to school. I was raised I was raised by my single mom who didn't have money. So I was not raised with money at all. And if I wanted anything, I had to pay for it by myself. And back then, you know, there was no GoFundMes or anything like that. So back when I was a kid, starting in third grade, man, I got a paper out. I had three paper outs. So if I wanted to play youth sports, if I wanted to play youth basketball, if I wanted to go bowling on the weekends or go to the movies, you know, I had to pay for it for myself. So third grade, I think age of eight, I got my first paper out, and I always had three. And, you know, back then, that's when the boys would wrap the bags around the handlebars of their bikes, and they would drive around and toss papers at the doorsteps, man. These kids don't know anything about that anymore, but
no, not at all. Papers
are, you know, but so I'd wake up, man, the first thing I have to do every day, and this was a Monday through Sunday thing. It was 7 days a week. The newspaper was every day. And first thing I would do is I'd wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and do my paper routes and go home, and I'd get ready to go to school. My mom would come home from her job while I was at school and go to job number two. And so I'd get home from school and she would never be there. So my early years was a lot of isolation. You know, it was a lot of me being alone. And, you know, that was my younger years. My mom, she worked, like I said, she worked her ass off and she tried hard. She wanted to be loved. And, you know, she wanted what everybody, man or woman, you know, in their, you know, early 20s, late teens, early 20s, mid 20s, they want to be loved. They want that affection. They want to live the party life. And so my mom tried to hold a good balance. And I can see back and I can look back to see, you know, the amazing things she did and how hard she tried. She wanted a man in her life so bad, not only for herself, but she also wanted a man in her life to be a father figure for me. You know, I know that she wanted that. She knew how much I was alone a lot. You know, my friends, the friends that I was close to, they all had two parent households. You know, they grew up with both parents in the household and most of them had siblings. So they always had somebody around and I never did. So I was always trying to reach out, but a lot of times there was no option. So I was by myself. And so my mom knew that. And so I think she always, you know, she wanted a boyfriend or a man in her life for her, but then also I know she wanted it for me. But my mom not being alone around a lot when I was young, you know, often put me together with these guys. And my mom would, a lot of times she would kind of reach and just try to grab anything that would take her. And so she brought some unsavory characters around. This is in Ventura, California. And, you know, put me in some situations that at the time I thought was normal, but in retrospect, definitely was not normal with either the men while she was at work or the men and their sons that they brought around. So, you know, I think 90 to 95% of most addicts in their childhood, they have multiple forms of abuse, whether it be physical, mental, sexual. You know, I'm definitely not any different or not much different when I say all the above were definitely part of my childhood and part of my story. And at that time, it was part of my normal. You know, we didn't know. I thought that's what every kid, you know, having mom's boyfriend touch them or do this or do that. You know, I just didn't know any different. I was young. I was naive. I trusted. And I think, you know, kids do. And then, you know, when you get older, you realize that that shit wasn't normal.
Not at all, dude. Not at all.
That's not normal. And so you realize that through whether it's watching movies and TV or you know, you get into high school and you start, you know, discussing things or junior high and you realize, shit, that's fucking not normal. But by this time, you're thoroughly embarrassed and you don't want to talk about it. You're embarrassed. You're disappointed in yourself. You think it's your fault when it's not. And you bottle it up. So that's where my addiction, I think, started was when I realized that shit, I had a lot of stuff happen to me as a kid that's some fucked up shit, and I was embarrassed. And so that got you mentally, which obviously I think lots of addicts suffer from stuff similar to that. But that was a kid growing up, man. I always worked my ass off. I had a paper out for 5 years. If I wanted to do anything, I had to get my own money. So that's one thing I've always been a really hard worker. I've always had multiple jobs. And so, you know, things from your childhood, things that you see every day and do everything in your younger years, you keep those habits and those qualities. And so I've always had that work ethic, but I always had this thing that was in the back of my head that, you know, I pushed away, that I didn't want to talk about. I didn't want to think about, you know. So, and that was those moments. So my drinking didn't really start until probably like my sophomore year in high school. I think I got drunk really for the first time, and it was fucking, I hated alcohol, man. I couldn't stand liquor. I think that's not too uncommon also. I know lots of friends that are alcoholics that they say the same thing. They didn't like it, but you know, we're trying to numb something, we're trying to push something away. So I think the first time I got drunk was like pepper and schnapps and orange juice, and I was at a friend's house because their parents were out of town. And man, as soon as that alcohol finally got there, I just chug, and I got blacked out drunk, puked everywhere, woke up in a bathtub full of ice and water the next morning. I was naked, and my friends were there like, dude, are you fucking okay? Like, oh my god, like, we didn't know what to do, so we threw you in the bathtub.
Were they like, trying to wake you up with the ice?
They thought I was gonna die, but they didn't want to call 911 because they didn't want my mom to get mad at me. So, you know, they didn't know what to do, so they threw me in a bathtub full of ice and water. And they probably saw that on some TV show or something, probably Growing Pains or something when we were young. You know, mind you, I'm 44, so we're talking the, you know, late 80s, 90s.
Yeah, dude, we grew up to the same stuff on TV.
Like, yeah, really, Fred Savage really and Wonder Years and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
When you have two knobs on the TV and you're just flipping channels. So, you know, my first couple experiences with alcohol, I hated it. I didn't even fucking like it. Nothing good. Nothing good came from it. It didn't taste good. And it blows my fucking mind that the one thing that fucking controlled my life and I thought I could not live without, that is something I didn't even fucking like. And that's very common, I think, with lots of us in addiction recovery. During our active addiction, I think that's a common thing. And it's because we're pushing something away, we're numbing something. And so I played sports in high school and college. I played football and baseball in college, and I didn't really drink that much in my early college years. But once I stopped playing sports, man, my early 20s, like 20, 21, 22, it was fucking on. It was just partying, drunk in publics, thinking it was just chasing girls, just absolute nonsense. Because the older I got, you know, the more time I had to, in my head, think about those things that happened to me. And, you know, the more you think about it, the more you push them away. But then the more you, like, is it your fault? Is this fault? This fucking shit happens. And then you just, you know, so many insecurities come up. You know, you're going to college and it's sex. And I think lots of addicts, you know, they use their drug of choice so they can perform better during sex, because you're just insecure about fucking everything in your life. And so, you know, whether you're shooting up and you just, you know, you want to just fuck all night long, so you shoot up. I never did that, never shot up, but I know lots of my friends that did. And, you know, I would drink, so you'd have, you know, the whiskey D, and you just go all night long. And it's just insecurity on insecurity, drinking and drinking and drinking. Yep. To inevitably just running away from the fucking real problem. And, you know, I never thought I had a problem. When I was in my early 20s, man, I had great jobs, I made good money, and I was just fucking wild. Like, my good friends that had good heads on their shoulders, you know, we would distance ourselves because they would distance themselves from me because they saw all the fucking just debauchery I was. And I don't blame them at all, and I never did. You know, my life just kept spiraling and spiraling, and alcohol was the only constant. You know, I've never been married. I had a couple long-term relationships that, you know, alcohol it ruined. You know, alcohol was probably a big part of them. You know, me and my exes, we drank a lot together. It was definitely a contributing factor, I think, to what ruined pretty much all the relationships. But I was also codependent. You know, I think codependency is a huge thing with addicts and their active addiction. You know, you don't want to be alone in your own misery.
Can't be alone. It's fucking sucks, dude.
It's real.
It does.
And it's that fucking insecurity, man. You're running away from one fucking thing. It's just causing all this other stuff. And, you know, in my early 20s, I didn't know. I had no fucking idea. But, yeah, addiction alcohol just kept taking everything more and more and more from me, man. Bought a house, and all of a sudden addiction was just destroying my life. Lost a house, lost cars, lost everything. Friendships, family members wanted nothing to do with me. You know, we don't realize, like, I thought things were normal. And I think I heard on one of your podcasts, you know, I think you were saying it, where you're just like, you thought you were the only one that this happens to, that it feels like this.
Yeah.
That this is fucking, it's just me. Like, other people don't have this problem. Like, nobody else will fucking understand. Like, oh my God, I wake up and I have to finish that fucking drink that's next to me that I passed out the night before, or else my delirium tremens and my shaking won't stop, or I can't get up, or I'm going to throw up. So I just drink, and then I'm drinking all day. And I was a 24/7 drinker for at least 10 years. Wow. I'd wake up and have to drink, and then all day long, man. And I really thought it was just me, and nobody else knew had any idea that, not only that I was going through that, but nobody else could understand, because this was just me. You know, I had that thought process in my head. So, and I think I heard you talking about that in a podcast a couple of days ago, but yeah, man, I didn't know there was programs out there available. You know, I got arrested. I got 5150 three times, and hopefully some of you guys that are listening to this, if anybody listens to this, doesn't know what 5150 means. That means you fucking are diagnosed crazy, so they throw you in for a mandatory 72-hour hold.
Been there.
yeah, right? I know you have. I heard that.
Good time.
So you know what that means. You know? And the first time, like, I got out, I remember the first time I 5150, my anxiety was just, it was awful. And I was at a point where I lived in a town called Temecula. And I was in Los Angeles for something, and I was just drinking. And I pulled over into, I think, a Jack in the Box or Taco Bell parking lot. I don't know what it was. And I had a full bottle of vodka from the plastic bottle from Ralph's or Vaughn's or whatever, you know, the fancy fucking five times filtered shit.
Yeah.
And I was just drinking. I couldn't move. And next thing I know, it's like 5 days later. And I literally in that same parking lot. And the only time I got out of my car was to go inside to Taco Bell or Jack, whatever it was, just get a little bit of food. And my best friends were calling me, and they're like, dude, where the fuck are you? And I was like, man, I can't. I literally, my anxiety was so bad, I couldn't move from the back seat to the driver's seat. I could not drive. My anxiety was just through the roof to a level that I had never experienced. And I was just like, fuck. So two of my friends came and got me, drove my car back, and they were like, all right, you have two options. We're taking you to fucking, taking you in for treatment for a 72-hour hold, or we're fucking, if you're not going to go with us, we're calling the ambulance on you. And so it took me into a fucking, oh my God, this is a nightmare spot. Riverside County, fucking 72 hours in this place that was just an absolute hell. And got out, and I think I maybe stayed sober for a day, and then just back at it and just on and off. Man, I called 911 on myself probably 6 months before I got into rehab and started a program. I was in South Central LA. I was staying with a friend on a friend's couch. It's like, I was kind of homeless then, but I was a friend. I had suckered them into letting me stay on their couch for like a week. And they knew I was drinking, but I would just drink and drink and drink. And one night they're like, get the fuck out of here, man. We're trying to help you, but you can't even fucking help yourself. Like, you're just killing yourself. We're not going to sit around and watch you just die. Like, you look like death. And they kicked me out, and I'm in South Central LA. And if I know you're on the East Coast, but
oh, I know.
South Central, South Central LA is not a good spot. So I'm wandering the streets, and I'm like getting in a couple fights. Got a couple people on their porch like threatening me, and I'm like getting in some fights. And I called 911 on myself, man. I called 911 on myself, and they came. And I was like, I'm on the corner of Normandy and 54th in South Central. And I started hitting a bush, and I got a call on my phone, and it was dispatch, and they're like, hey, the cops are there looking for you. And I was like, I'm in this fucking bush over here hiding. And so the cops came, they put me in a straitjacket, bro. They came and they fucking put me in a straitjacket, threw me back in the car, 5150 me again. And man, I got out 72 hours later, fucking hopped on a bus in the little jumpsuit they give you, hopped on a fucking bus. Went to a friend's house. Friend gave me $20. I went to Ralph's, got a fucking handlebar, and just went on a bender again, man. And God, it was just life was interesting. And then you know, we don't need to get any more, but I found a government funded rehab program in Venice Beach, and my probation officer turned me into it and said, "Hey, I'm going to get you a bed in this place." And it's ironic because this program, like I said, there's 53 guys straight out of prison or off the streets. Most of them didn't want to get, had no intention on getting clean or sober. And they just wanted to be there instead of prison. And it was like prison. I've never been to prison. I've been to jail a dozen times, the longest for 2 weeks. But LA County is no joke. It's like a prison. Fucking, my last name is Hernandez, but I ran Wood in county. And for those of you who haven't been in jail, thank God. When you walk in, if you're going same for a couple weeks, you walk in and it's like a basketball gymnasium, and there's 50 bunk beds. So there's 100 people in there, and you walk in and you got the leader from every race is up the front with the newbies. They walk in, they pull you aside. So the blacks pull the blacks, the Mexicans pull the Mexicans, come with us. The whites, you know, they call us Woods, the woodpeckers, they call it, they grab the whites. And my last name is Hernandez, but I don't have any tattoos and I look white. So the leader of the Woods came up to me and I was like, "Well, my last name's Hernandez, what should I do?" And he's like, "You're coming with us. You're not fucking going with the Mexicans." So LA County was definitely a fucking experience. But anyways, I get in this program, man, and there wasn't a lot of recovery going on. But when I walked up those stairs, the day I checked myself in, I had probably like two t-shirts, a couple pairs of socks, a couple pairs of underwear, a couple pairs of shorts. And that was all I had to my name. I'd been homeless for months and months and months in the same area. And that's all I had to my name. And I said, if I'm going to be in this, I just thought to myself, I'm like, if I'm going to be in this place for 6-7 months with these kind of people, I'm going to shut the fuck up for the first time in my life. I'm going to be humble as shit. I'm going to do everything I was told, everything. If a counselor told me something, I did it. Anybody that had a lifestyle that I wanted, and that's what the counselors and staff had, yeah, I was going to do whatever the fuck they said. And I did, man. I was deep in the NA book. I was deep in the Bible. I found God again. I journaled like a motherfucker. Journaling was a godsend for me in recovery.
Oh, yeah.
I read. I worked out. I was down in that basement gym, man. First couple months, you can't leave this place. And there's drugs everywhere in this place. There's guns. There's fights. It's just like being on the streets. It's just like being in jail. 53 guys. You know, when you can't leave a fucking house for months and you're bottled up in this place, it's just, you know, you get on each other's nerves. But I just, for the first time in my life, like something, God, it was a God shot, man. And I told myself, and I was like, if you're going to be here, you're going to do it. You're going to fucking do this. And I did it. And I knuckled down. And one shirt, I had one shirt in there with me, one of the four shirts, three shirts I brought, it actually said Valor on the chest.
Oh, wow.
And awesome. Yeah, I had bought it years before at a TJ Maxx, and I bartended in Santa Monica, this really popular bar. Yeah. And I got it, and I thought it was so cool. It had Valor really bold across the chest. And if you go into one of my posts, I talk about it, and there's a picture of me in 2016 in rehab with this shirt on. But I wore a bartender, and I thought it was the funniest shit ever, and everybody commented on it. I thought it was so cool. And I brought it into my rehab with me. It was one of the few items I had on me. And just through putting in the work in the gym and putting in the work upstairs, and the best work I did, the most important thing I did, is I went to fucking mental health therapy and I went to counseling, and I shut the fuck up and I cried like I've never cried before to my counselors. I told them everything. I was like, if you're gonna do this, you're gonna fucking do it.
Once those floodgates,
you're not gonna fucking half-ass this shit. What's that?
Once those floodgates open, boy, it's hard to close them.
I had never fucking cried. My counselor was this little old black lady, man, and I had never cried before in my life. Like, I cried in front of this lady that I didn't even know. And then I just got addicted. You know, we have that personality. I got addicted to fucking counseling. I got addicted to just telling my people all the shit that I had bottled up. I couldn't get enough. Like, this is a government-funded program, so their resources were really limited, but they allowed us, once you get to a certain point, you've been there long enough, they allow you out of the house for a little bit, and you can go to like county buildings and use different resources and go to the library or something like that. So I went out and found a couple other counselors that I was able to go see through government funded programs. You know, I just did that on my own. I was like, fuck, I need this. Like, wow. I was noticing for the first time in my life a change. And I knew it was all because I was being honest with myself, being honest with another person, and attacking the things that I had just numbed and bottled up and pushed away for so many years. So this was the growth, and I was just like, fuck, man. So I did it. And then I went to counseling multiple times a week. I did groups every day. I just surrendered for the first time in my life, man. I surrendered, and that, for us, that's a hard thing to do, is to realize, you know, we're powerless over alcohol. You know, that's one of the main things. Like, you know, I fucking started reading shit and stuff that I had memorized. Like, I think that I memorized like the Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept. You know, I knew that by heart, but I didn't know what the words were actually meant. And I was like, I remember the first time I was like, actually thought about the Serenity Prayer, and I was like, fuck, like serenity. Grant me the serenity, accept things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, etc. I was like, fuck, when you think about that, it's like, it's powerful. It's like sometimes like you'll memorize a song, you know, you'll know all the words to a song, but those lyrics can say the stupidest, fucking dumbest shit, but because it's catchy, you've memorized it and you're singing it, but you're not realizing what you're saying. And then when I realized like the power behind some of this stuff, and I was just like, fuck, man, I was like, it was just, everything was happening. Like this, the, you know, life just started getting good. And it was because I, you know, started racking up days of sobriety, and, you know, you start racking up more and more days, and fuck, man, shit gets good.
One of the most powerful things that I ever was taught, as sobriety goes on, as you start to put more and more days together, you know, one day at a time, God willing, is how little control you ever had in the first place. And how, you know, just that you never had control over anything, and that you never had control over, like, there's so much stuff. I mean, even you don't have control over like urges. If you get an urge, you gotta fight that off. You gotta do something. You got the tools, you know, you gotta pray, you gotta call somebody. But, you know, we're such control freaks when we're out there, such narcissists at the core, that we just wanted more and more and more. We thought we could control and manipulate, and then once you hit that rock bottom, like that final rock bottom where you find yourself where you were, you realize, I don't control anything at all. I don't control anything, and you're lucky to be alive. And that's what's really the grace of God, you know. And that's where you find yourself, you know, when you finally do get sober. That it's just, it's powerful, dude. And then you go out there and you're able to help people, and it just is like, wow, I have no control over anything, and I'm really happy about that. Like, it's like a burden that was lifted off you. You don't have to worry about anything, because you really can't control anything in the first place. So the only thing you could do is help and pray.
Man, when you just nailed it. You had no control. You know, all in my active addiction towards the end, you know, the only thing you fucking think about is, when are you going to get that next drink? For me, it's like, when am I going to get off work so I can go get that drink? And where is it? Do I have enough at home, or am I going to have to stop at the store on the way? And when I'm going home, do I have enough to get me not only through the night, but then through the morning and the next day? Because I'm going to need more liquor in the morning before I can get to the store or get to work or do this. It's like, I didn't control my body. Fucking alcohol controlled me.
Yeah.
You know, alcohol controlled everything. Like, I love when I talk to people and they have no idea what the fuck I'm talking about because they never lived it. I love people that don't have this disease. I genuinely, in my heart, do. I don't wish this upon anybody. Yeah. It's like, man, like, it controls your fucking mind. Like, everything, all you think about, you know, I think when you're young and you're in school and, like, you start going through, like, sex ed and shit like that, they tell you, you know, it's always the guys. They're, oh, guys think about sex every 43 seconds or something like that. And it's true as shit. It's fucking true. It's true. But the reality also in addiction is the addict thinks about their drug of choice every fucking 10 to 15 seconds, if that. And, man, that was just so real. Everything I did, I would be somewhere physically, mentally, I was already with my next drink and where it was going to be or how was I going to have to get it.
Yeah.
You know, that's all there was to it, just plain and simple. I may have physically been somewhere, but if I didn't have a drink in my hand and I wasn't drinking with you or we weren't partying, I was thinking about where I needed to be and how I was going to get it. And that was all that mattered to my life. It controlled my mind, body, and soul. And I was completely powerless over addiction. And fuck, man, being able to be on the other side of it is just such a fucking godsend, and it's so amazing, and I'm so grateful. And just the shit your mind does. Like, I'm with my clothing line. So I started my clothing line. I was like, you know what? I want everybody to feel what I felt. I started getting sober. I started feeling fucking amazing. I started getting in shape. Mm-hmm. You know, just I started getting my self-esteem, my self-worth, and my dignity back. And, you know, I felt like the first time in my life that I actually deserved this air that I was breathing and this space on this earth that I was taking up. I felt like I deserved it for the first time because I never felt like I was deserving of any of it before. You know, I never would have admitted that, of course, but, you know, deep down inside, I never did. And so when you flip the switch and you start putting in the work and you realize how good life is and you start just truly like, wow, like I wanted that for everybody, you know? My story is one of relapse over the last couple of times, which, you know, that's my story. What the fuck ever. But the first time I got sober, yeah, right. We haven't all been there, but, you know, that's a topic that gets brought up a lot. Relapse is part of addiction. No, relapse is not a part of addiction. Relapse is part of, you know, people will be like, relapse is part of recovery. And then other people will be like, no, relapse is part of addiction. And I get both sides. You know, I'm not here to judge anybody. It happens. And you know, God willing, we bounce back. But shit, I lost my train of thought. So the first time I got sober, I got to 11 months. And man, I was like that evangelical religious person that everybody hates that tries to convert everybody to their religion. I thought everybody had to be sober. It was just the end all. You needed to be it. I was so fucking hardcore. Yeah. Working at a bar and restaurant still, but I was like, everybody needs to be sober. And people would tell me, they'd be like, man, Jim, you just need a fucking relapse, bro. Maybe you need to drink or something like that. And I'd be like, fuck you. But another topic I want to get into is I relapsed because of a girl. So I want to get into dating and recovery. So I relapsed at 11 months. And honestly, I thought I was done. I know lots of us, we can look back and things, and we can say, you know, I knew I wasn't done. I knew I was, you know, still going to drink. And I thought I was done drinking forever, but I wasn't. And I got close to a year, and I was like, getting close to a year gave me anxiety, man. I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
I'd been 2 weeks sober before only because I was in jail. And I don't know how I didn't drink in jail because it was everywhere. And I just said no to it. But I was all of a sudden 8 months sober, 9 months sober, and then 11 months sober, and I just got scared, man. I was just the anxiety. I was like, fuck, a year, and I was in my head again. And I relapsed because of a chick, because I knew I was hanging out with a girl, and I knew it was probably going to, you know, go down like that, and started drinking. You know, your insecurities, you put in a lot of work to in the mental health therapist, you know, therapy area and counseling, but, you know, you things happen. Shit. So I relapsed, and I put the on again, off again thing for about 2 years. I'd get to 6 months, I'd relapse. I'd get to 3 months, I'd relapse. But I've lost my train of thought again. This addict mind. But so my clothing line, I just wanted everybody to have what I had. And so I started my clothing line about a year out of rehab. And you know, I dedicated it to aiding and inspiring those in recovery. I go back to my transitional rehab facility. I try to go back every month. During COVID, they haven't allowed me that much. I still go back and I donate clothes. I go, and when it's not COVID, I go talk to the 53 guys that are in there, man. I go and I spend 3 or 4 hours in there and I talk to them. I'm like, man, I'm sitting in these fucking chairs that you guys were sitting in just a couple of years ago, you know, months ago, et cetera, however long it was. I just go to facilities. They call them H&I, hospitals and institutions. You know, hopefully a lot of people don't know what those terminology is, but it's terminologies. Hospitals and institutions are places that, you know, people in recovery go to and they speak. It's kind of like an AA meeting, but for people that are in hospitals or prisons, yeah, or jail or whatever it is.
I've been there. Yep. I've been
People
are still like drooling, you know, because they're coming off stuff and they're under, man, you know, sedated and stuff, you know.
Yeah. But, you know, recovery is about, you know, recovery is so much more than just simply not drinking. Like, granted, like, fuck yeah, recovery is don't drink, don't use. At all costs, if you can, like, just fucking do that, and that's recovery. But then recovery is about changing everything. Also, it's about changing your mindset. It's about changing what you listen to. It's about changing, you know, who you put yourself around. You know, they say don't change one thing, change everything, and it's fucking true. And recovery is about, you know, being selfless for the first time in your life and not being selfish and being genuine in that. I get no better joy than helping people out, man. All I cared about was myself. It was all me. And, you know, I get no better joy than going in and spending time with 53 guys straight out of prison and, you know, talking to them, and, you know, whether I can just look in their eyes and tell them, you know, you have no intent on getting sober. You're just here. And that's fine. You know, that's their story. And, but, you know, I go down to Skid Row and I feed the homeless people. And it's just such a...
Yeah, dude, that's great. Thing. When I saw that, oh, man, it's wonderful that you do that.
Man, you know, I do it, and I do it because I was there. You know, I was never homeless in actual Skid Row of downtown Los Angeles, but I was homeless in Venice Beach and Santa Monica, and I slept in carports, and I slept in streets. I slept under lifeguard stands, man. I would sneak up on people's patios and steal the cushions off their patio furniture and then go find a little cut somewhere to sleep in so I can have a cushion so I can be comfortable. And I was, you know, I was homeless. I was never in Skid Row, but, you know, people, you know, not often, but once in a while, they'd be like, how do you do that, man? Like, that terrifies me. But you're not scared of what you've done. Like, what I've been there. It's like, I'm not afraid of it because I've been there.
Yeah.
So, but, recovery is being of service, and you hear that often, and it's just so fucking true. It's when you can take your recovery and not only stay sober yourself, but then when you can help other people and genuinely do that, it's just, man, it's fucking amazing. And I get so much more out of it than anybody else that I go and I give them a couple shirts and some food, some bottled waters, you know, give them 3 hours of my time. I get more out of it than they do. And people say that when I was in early recovery, you know, people that come and speak in meetings and whatnot, and they would come in and I'd be, hey, I get more out of this than I'm giving to you. And, you know, early recovery, like, fucking bullshit. Fuck you. You're just, you know, you're full of shit. But, you know, it's true. I get so much. I almost feel selfish because I get so much out of being of service to others. And so my clothing line, man, is just about just aiding and inspiring people, you know, just never to judge anybody because I was there, but just to be here to, you know, physical fitness is such a great tool in any kind of recovery, whether it's an eating disorder, whether it's a handicap, whether it's any kind of recovery. Physical fitness not only get your endorphins back, but you like happened to me, you get your self-worth back, your self-esteem, your dignity. You just feel good about yourself, man.
We're very similar in that aspect with the physical, you know, mind, body, yeah, spirit, all that stuff.
Man, I'm telling you. When I was in my early 20s, I worked out. I've always worked out a lot. And I look back, and in my early 20s, I was really big. I was in great shape. I was just a fucking monster. And I was addicted to working out as well as I was addicted to the alcohol back then. But I know why I was, because I thought, hey, we're super insecure. And so, you know, if I look a certain way, all the ladies will like me. I'll get any girl I want, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in my mind, if I got myself to looking away and I got myself to being this big, no man would ever fucking try to touch me again. And so that was a little bit of it, is I wanted it to be so fucking mean. I was so angry inside. I was so hurt that if I got buff and I was fucking yoked and I would be in the gym and I was that cruncher and I was that screamer, and if I got myself looking a certain way, no fucking man would ever fucking come up to me and try to touch me again. And if they did, they were going to fucking have a hell to be paid. And so that was stuck with me from my childhood. I was never going to allow myself to be touched again. So that was a lot of me working out young. And then when you recover and you go through the healing process and growth, it's just such a powerful tool, you know, such a powerful tool in recovery. So it's that's why I started my fitness clothing line dedicated to, you know, recovery, and why it's a fitness clothing line, because physical fitness is super important.
It sounds like you use it as a defense mechanism, rightfully so, and then it grew into something that is healthy, positive, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. I work out a lot too, and I'm like, what, 6 foot, 220, 225, tattoos, and people are like, oh, you look scary. I'm like, I'm just a big teddy bear, trust me.
Right?
I am, yeah. Really. It had nothing to do with that. I kind of like it, you know? I always did. I've always been just like, yeah, I mean, I can be like a little temperamental, I guess anyone could, but I mean, I haven't laid a hand on anyone in, you know, so long, years, and I have no intentions. I'm just a big teddy bear. I like it because of the health aspects. I mean, like you said, the endorphins. And I think it really helps me stay on the beam, because sometimes if you're stressed out, you know, going to the gym is like really beneficial and therapeutic. You have no idea, you know, some people.
And this is during this whole COVID time, man. I would not want to be in early recovery during this COVID time. And anybody that is in early recovery, And staying sober is a fucking miracle in my mind, because all the tools that I've ever used are not available to me anymore. And any of us, most of us, I live in Los Angeles, so meetings are still closed. The gyms are still closed. You know, fucking society is still closed in LA. But so, you know, what we learned in recovery was go to meetings, you know, stay connected, go to the gym, go outside in nature, go get grounded. Yeah, none of that shit's available anymore.
No, so. It's hard, I know.
It's tough.
This is perfect. Getting at least we could talk for like a good solid almost like an hour, you know, and share, you know, each other's thoughts. But sometimes it gets rough, man.
It does. Zoom meetings are good. You know, I think I grabbed on more to Zoom meetings recently than early COVID. What's that?
I spoke in an outdoor event, a hybrid. I spoke online and outdoors. It's kind of weird, but I did.
Okay. Yeah.
People were like seated like out in the grass, like it was like a concert, and I'm just like yapping into a mic that's hooked up to a computer that's hooked up to speakers. And I got these two lamps in front of me and I can't see anything. It's pitch black. So all I see is the flies going around and a mosquito's going around a lamp circling, like, you know, fresh meat, you know? I can't see anything. And I'm like, I'm totally fine right now. It's like, this is great.
Man, I'm telling you, I never thought I would. I mean, I love meetings and I always have, but I mean, I've never thought I would miss them as much as I do now.
Oh my God.
Like, genuinely miss them. It's like, shit, get me to one ASAP.
We're getting a little better over here, and I'm on the border with New York State, so they had indoor dining last month, and we have indoor dining now. But the gyms, I went and bought a Universal, and I got the Bowflex dumbbells and all that stuff. Like, so I knew, like, I should prepare myself. I should take a room in the house and make it just a gym. That's exactly what I did, and just prepare myself for, like, you know, the zombie apocalypse, which is not going to happen. I'm kind of a little bummed out about the zombie thing, but, you know, hopefully people don't die for no reason.
Oh, man.
I watch a lot of sci-fi, too.
I've never been into sci-fi for whatever reason, but yeah. I feel like our life was sci-fi for a long time, you know what I mean? But
so you got everything going. I mean, you're like a miracle. You know, we're all miracles. We're all miracles. And speaking, staying connected with each other. You know, is there anything, we're going to finish up, is there anything you want to say that really you thought about, maybe telling people that, you know, don't let the sun go down, you know, fight as much as you can, get sober, get help, go out there, tell someone how you feel, you know? Is there anything you have to talk about, or maybe something you want to tell people?
You know, what I'm big on, and I hold myself accountable a lot, and, you know, I think in sobriety, you have a conscious mind and a subconscious mind, and your subconscious mind is so powerful. I think we all know that. Yeah. So it's definitely way more powerful than your conscious mind. And so, you know, you really have to think about things you do. You can't just react. You have to fucking think about things and live in your conscious mind and think things. You just can't react. And the one thing that I've done that has gotten, and it's tough, that it's gotten me the best results is you know, it's about grounded action. You know, motivation. When I speak a lot, you know, I talk to people. We're in an active addiction. You know, we talked a lot and we didn't fucking do shit. We were talkers, not doers. And you know, lots of people get motivated, and getting motivated is an easy thing, but motivation is a feeling. You know, life is about grounded fucking action, like doing stuff. Motivation is a feeling. It goes away. It feels great. It lasts 20 seconds, last couple minutes, but it's gone. You know, being about grounded action, putting foot to pavement. When you say you're going to do something, do it. If you say you're going to, you know, give anybody your word on anything, follow through with it, and grounded action and just discipline. You know, discipline is such a powerful thing, and it's the things that we had the least of in active addiction. And don't change one thing, change everything. It's just about grounded action. Don't think about things and say you're going to do things. Just fucking shut up and do it. You know, don't talk about it. Just do it.
I hear you.
You know, I love people that you know, are warriors on IG about recovery, or about, you know, Black Lives Matters, or about, mm-hmm. you know, Donald Trump, or about this or about that. You know, they post all the emojis and all that stuff. And that's good, because that maybe that's their platform. Maybe they live in the sticks and you know they don't have access to go to a protest or a march or something like that, or you know they don't have that, and that's the way they contribute and help other people, and that's awesome. But for me, it's about grounded fucking actions, foot to pavement. It's about doing stuff. Like I have access to go, and I didn't miss any of the protests during you know, the Black Lives Matter. Yeah. I have 2 blocks from City Hall, so you know the one thing I could do is I could be out there, and if I was just shutting up and listening to what other people said, I was there and I was part of it, you know, in recovery, going out and doing the things. Yep. That, you know, be the change that you want to see. People say that. Be the change that you want to see. People say things so much. They say all the cliches. You'll say something, they'll hit that 100 button on the post. They'll be like, hell yeah. But they don't do anything. They're just saying it. So don't be a talker, be a doer. It's about grounded action. Motivation's cute, but motivation doesn't get shit done. Grounded action does it, and it's just about results. And you know, I think one of the things that we all hated about ourselves the most in active addiction is that, you know, we didn't do enough. Like we would think it, but we never fulfilled our word.
We had no discipline. No discipline.
Yeah. I was the king of empty promises. You know, I was the king of empty promises. So it's about, if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. And you might not hear that much from me, but I guarantee you're going to see it.
Oh, I see it, dude. I see it every day. Every time I see you post something, I see action. I don't see words, and that's what I like.
That's what comes across,
and that's what people are going to take into account, and they're going to look at that. You always judge someone by their actions, you know, not what they say. I could sell, you know, a story to someone, but I'm full of shit if I don't come through on it, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Yeah, man. And I feel blessed beyond my wildest dreams that I'm still alive, because there's no way I should be fucking alive. There's just no way. Lots of us, I think, have that. And I'm just grateful, you know? And gratitude goes a long way. being grateful, man, it's such a good feeling. It's a little bit of gratitude can get you a long way. So I'm blessed beyond my wildest dreams for life and to be here with you talking right now, man.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, I appreciate you.
Yeah, I appreciate you too. And I appreciate
I'm glad Tiffin too asked me to come on here, man. There's some friends from IG, you know.
Yeah.
That community's fun. And so I had a couple common friends, Tiffany and Sue, that asked me, like, hey, get in touch with Steve and get on his podcast. And I was like, hell yeah.
This is a good dude. We got a good group, solid group that people can just attach to. The more the merrier.
We do. We definitely do. I'm blessed for that too. You know, and it's genuine too. It's absolute genuine.
All right.
It's like some of these people. Yeah, hey, I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much, Steve.
I'll add this up in no time.
I'm looking forward to listening to it.
I'll give you a buzz in a little while.
All right, appreciate it, man. All right. Have a good one.
Okay.
Bye.